The final case on this afternoon's schedule for this panel's oral argument is Frey v. Goodsell, case number 58391. Before we begin, counsel, I'd like to recognize the presence of the members of the George Whittell High School senior class. We are very grateful and appreciative that you would come here today, and we welcome your presence in order to maybe assist you in hearing the arguments today. I'm going to ask the two lawyers to give a brief outline of the facts of the case, and then we'll get into the legal arguments as we progress during the regular oral argument session. After the arguments have been concluded, I'd like to more formally introduce my colleagues and invite you to ask us questions about the process and whatever other issues you may like to comment about concerning the judicial branch of government. So before we do that, counsel, if you'd introduce yourselves and tell them a little briefly what your perspective is about the facts of the case, and then we'll go from there.
Hi, my name is Elliot Blue. I represent a gentleman named Dr. Emil Frey, who's a cancer researcher. And basically, the general facts of the case are when Dr. Frey moved out to Las Vegas, when his wife was there living, an attorney named Dan Goodsell drafted a number of documents for Dr. Frey to sign, and in essence transferred most, if not all, of his assets into his wife's trust. When his wife passed away, his stepson had control of those assets. Both sides, the stepson and then Dr. Frey and I represented, sought to, grab control of those assets. And in there, what brings us here today is we had filed a motion to disqualify this attorney, Dan Goodsell, his name here, who drafted these documents. And on the grounds of, we thought it was inappropriate for an attorney to defend against documents that he drafted, but defend against the person who signed them. And the probate commissioner and then the district court in Las Vegas found that that was correct and he was disqualified. So subsequent to that being resolved, there was what's called a malpractice lawsuit filed by Dr. Frey against Mr. Goodsell, asserting that since they had an attorney-client relationship, the standard practice, standard of care, if you're an attorney, if you're going to draft documents for the client, you have to meet with the client and make sure that's what the client wants. And in there, especially with the legal issues, you'll hear arguments about whether the prior probate court orders should have been applied in the other action. And because they weren't, we went to trial, and the jury basically found that there was no attorney-client relationship, and Dr. Frey appealed. That's what he's here today.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Booth. Mr. Cotton.
Good afternoon. I'm John Cotton. I'm attorney from Las Vegas. I'm representing Dan Goodsell and his law firm, Goodsell Holson, in this case. Obviously, as you see here, you know I don't agree with everything that you said. I didn't hear why. Basically, it did start out with some transfers of some assets of Dr. Frey to his wife's trust at the behest of the son-in-law, the wife's son. He had powers of attorney that were issued by both Frey, Dr. Frey and his wife. And those powers of attorney authorized him to act on their behalf in transfers of assets. He came to my client, Mr. Goodsell, and said, here's what we want to do. We've got a large insurance policy going to some of the children, and they want to equalize the assets because that's going to his children, and they want to equalize assets by transferring them into the Adora Frey Trust so that each of the children, both the stepchildren and regular children, would receive some of the benefits. Mr. Goodsell prepared those documents and gave them to Mr. Brock, and Mr. Brock in turn returned signed documents, which did in fact transfer the assets and equalize things. After the fact, the children got into a dispute. Those that are Dr. Frey's natural children and his stepchildren, and there was a motion to disqualify Mr. Goodsell on the basis that he had a conflict in representing anyone in the case. There were a couple of arguments and disputes on that, and Mr. Goodsell was disqualified, and the parties came in with a new counsel, substituting in for Mr. Goodsell in the middle of the process, actually pretty early on, and they continued up to a settlement of the case. We tried the lawsuit, they sued Mr. Goodsell for malpractice, certainly in the past prior to the malpractice had been committed. We were taking the position that he had not committed malpractice, that in fact he was not his client, that he was acting at the behest of the durable power of attorney son-in-law in preparing documents that had prepared the property. Expert testimony was elicited by both of the sides of the case in front of the jury. There was a lot of testimony about why this wasn't a joint client relationship, kind of over my head because there were probate lawyers putting this testimony on. But the jury heard all of that, heard all of the testimony from Dr. Fry, saw the documents that were clear on their face, and came back with a verdict in favor of Mr. Goodsell. The case was dismissed by the judge after the jury ruled in favor of Mr. Goodsell against Dr. Fry. And basically, what we're up here arguing today is some of the court's rulings that she made on admission of evidence, admission of testimony regarding attorney-client privilege and admission of testimony or exclusion of testimony regarding some documents that were placed in evidence at the time of trial.
All right, thank you, Mr. Cotton. Mr. Brewer, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Thank you. My name is Elliot Blue. I represent Dr. Emil Fry. I'm going to do my best to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. I think it's important to first take a look at how everything started going back. I'll quickly go through it. But in 2008, Dr. Fry retired more or less to Las Vegas, and he was living next door to his son-in-law. And what led to the initial trust filings were there was documents prepared by Dan Goodsell, an attorney, for Dr. Fry's signature, which included 16 assignments of account, transferring more than $1 million, quitclaim deed to their home, a trust amendment to Dr. Fry's trust, and two codicils. Once Mrs. Fry passed away, all the transfers were to Mrs. Fry and the Dora Fry Trust. When she passed away, Mr. Goodsell filed a petition to confirm all those transfers. So we asked the probate court to take jurisdiction, which Commissioner Yamashita did. At the same time, Dr. Fry filed, in essence, a counter-petition to rescind all of these documents. Shortly into the matter, by about 2 months, there was a motion to disqualify Dan Goodsell, filed by my office, basically pointing out that since Mr. Goodsell granted these and had both an attorney-client relationship, because he drafted documents that had testimonial nature, especially the trust and the codicil, that they had an attorney-client relationship, and he was disqualified from now defending against a challenge by the very gentleman that he represented in drafting these documents. Mr. Goodsell had a full opportunity to oppose this. He not only did the written brief opposing our motion to disqualify, but he also argued the motion. Commissioner Yamashita found, and specifically in his report and recommendation, attorney-client relationship was formed. Then an objection was filed, as is the standard practice. If you don't like the report and recommendation, it then went to the chief judge. I think now it's a probate judge after this court made some rulings regarding should the family law oversee these. But at the time, Judge Ritchie was the chief judge. There's some mention in the briefs that it's some type of family court issue. That's just not the case. There's an oral argument, which is part of the record. Mr. Goodsell briefed it, the objection. He also argued at the oral argument. Arguably, he did not have it. Judge Ritchie specifically said, I don't think you could be disqualified unless there's an attorney-client relationship. So the issues were fully briefed, fully argued, fully litigated at that time. The probate commissioner's report and recommendation was confirmed and became the order. At the end of the trust litigation, which is where we get to, I think the real issue we have is the factors for issue preclusion. I think the real fight is over, was there a final appealable order? I think that's what we are really here about. NRS 155.190, which we cited, is called appealable orders, and that has the orders that are appealable. That includes things such as instructing a trustee, directing the payment of claims, distributing property. We look at the order, it's in the appendix 241, although it's probably in there several times. It's the order approving settlement. This is not just a stipulation of dismissal where the parties sign a stipulation and it's a two-line document. Please vacate the trial date. This is an order, maybe called approving settlement, but it does a lot of different things. That it describes what assets that were in the Adair Fry Trust go to Dr. Fry. It resolves different claims that are being made by Dr. Fry. It resolves payments of certain claims. It directs the trustee of the Adair Fry Trust to take certain action. So this was appealable on three different levels. One, although there's no Nevada case law in California, a disqualification order is directly appealable. If that's not utilized in the Wade case, which we cited in our brief, a petition for writ of mandamus can be taken, and then a denial of that writ can be appealable. Neither of those, but you don't even need to get to that. Although those would be sufficient grounds to find that the order disqualifying Mr. Goodsell became final, is under NRS 155.190, this is one of the specific delineated orders that can be appealed to this court. To say that, well, this was a standard stipulation dismissal misses the point, because you need, it's particularly the probate court, you need orders. Once the court has jurisdiction, any payment out of that must be ordered by the court. Then the probate matters are not just dismissed. There must be a court order providing for the disposition of the assets and what the trustee is to do. And so fast forwarding to the malpractice action, obviously one of the key elements is that there must be an attorney-client relationship in order for the attorney to be liable for malpractice. Initially, there was a verbal order by the district court and then later a written order agreeing with our position, finding that that Mr. Goodsell was precluded by issue preclusion from asserting the lack of an attorney-client relationship. For reasons that were not clear, 1 week later, on the motion in limine, the district court said that it did not believe that Judge Ritchie intended for the order to have collateral estoppel effect, which I don't believe is the standard. Either if something is final on the merits, it has collateral estoppel effect, or it doesn't. And also said that, I think the line is that it wasn't a realistically appealable order. But that ignores the probate court jurisdiction and the June 22 probate court order that specifically was appealable. Almost the entire opposition is based upon the Juros case, G-U-R-O-S-C, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, which is the Massachusetts case, which really is of no assistance on two grounds. Number one, it has an essential to the judgment element, which we don't have in Nevada. Number two, that case was dismissed by a stipulation order, and in fact, in that case, we didn't cite in our brief, but it's part of the respondent's appendix, at 36, that the stipulation order in the Juros case says, in quotes, all appeals are waived. So it's starkly different than this case, where we have an appealable probate order, versus this other matter, where the party seeking to get issue preclusion effect of the disqualification order specifically and intentionally waive all appeals. We cited the testimony from Mr. Goodsell's expert, where he admits that the standard of care requires that you meet with your client, that you explain documents to your client, that you sit with them. You have to find out what your client's intentions are. It was all but stipulated at trial that none of that occurred, and the defense was, we are not his attorney. Mr. Goodsell testified to it. Their expert, Mr. Rushforth, testified to it. Had the collateral estoppel been given to that position, none of that testimony would have come in. The jury would have heard that there was an attorney-client relationship.
So you're basically putting all your eggs in that one basket that the collateral estoppel applies.
Correct, because I think that would have precluded their entire defense to the case. It would have entirely gutted it, because they would have had to admit, yes.
What's the factors you have to consider with regard to issue conclusion, though?
Well, no, I think there's the four factors that are in there. I think we have all of them met. We have the identical issue, which is the identical issue. We disqualified them on the attorney-client relationship. The final rule on the merits I discussed. The parties must be identical. This is identical parties. It's Mr. Goodsell and it's Dr. Fry. And it was necessarily litigated. As I pointed out, it was litigated both, the district court said four times. I think it was maybe just twice in a written ruling. But the probate commissioner litigated it and Judge Ritchie litigated it.
So are you saying actually or necessarily litigated?
I think it was actually and necessarily.
I think assuming you look at it that it was actually litigated, but was the litigation, the determination of the attorney-client privilege relevant to the trust proceedings at all?
Well, I think it was relevant to the trust proceedings because if who represented Dr. Fry and who drafted these documents was certainly relevant because how did at the core was what import should be given to these documents? Are they to be enforced or are they to be rescinded? And who drafted the documents and how that came about was important.
So was that actually, was that litigated that Goodsell was in fact Fry's attorney in the trust proceeding?
I think it was litigated to the extent it was part of the motion to disqualify and the objection in front of Judge Ritchie, and there's certainly testimony on it in the trust hearing, but I think it was necessarily...
That was just to disqualify him acting in the trust proceeding.
Correct, but based on the attorney's, certainly based upon him having an attorney-client relationship. That was that's in the report and recommendation, and that's a direct quote from Judge Ritchie in the transcript we provided. So it was actually and necessarily litigated between the two that there was this relationship, because if it didn't exist, then Mr. Goodsell would have been able to go forward representing Mr. Brock against Dr. Fry. He would have been able to. But the jury would have never heard any of this testimony. In fact, they would have heard that it was his attorney. And that's the reversible error. I think briefly, because I want to save some time for rebuttal on the parole evidence rule, I think the distinction is this is Sentner's intent is why the parole evidence rule should come in. It's not a standard it's not a standard case of two parties are signing a document. I do believe that you must be a party to that. I know the case law we cited with that is silent, but in California there is case law, and the reasons are clear that if one party signed a document and another party was a stranger to that document, the stranger should not be able to come in and preclude any conversation about that document because they don't have anything to do with it. They don't know about it. And I think most importantly is this, the documents are not clear and unambiguous on their face. There's documents that are trust amendments. You must know if you're going to amend your trust, you have to know what the original trust is and all other amendments. It was a third amendment. There's also two codicils. In order to prepare a codicil, you must know what the original will says. There's also a document called a declination to act. And if you take the documents in their totality together, Dr. Fry, in essence, was presented with documents that he declined to act, and then, for example, on a Monday and on Tuesday, transferred all of his assets into this trust that he now declined to act as a successor trustee. And to say that that's clear and unambiguous to a man in his 80s who suffers from Parkinson's, I think is you're giving him too much credit, but it's clearly not the law, not what the parole evidence rule is meant to stand for. With that, unless there's any questions, I'll save time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you, Mr. Groot.
Thank you.
Mr. Groot. Mr. Cotton, next
time. May it please the court. This is fundamentally a case, at least asserted by the plaintiff petitioner, of collateral estoppel in this application to the events at the trial before Judge Bell. It also deals with the parole evidence rule, which deals with fundamentally all of the damages that they were attempting to assert there. The case was fully tried. There were experts on both sides on the standard of care and ultimately a trial on damages, even though prior to trial the plaintiff did not have an expert on that issue. But the plaintiff cited in their opening brief to this court the City of Reno versus Reno Police case. And that one says that collateral estoppel issue preclusion only precludes parties from re-litigating issues actually decided and necessary to a judgment in an earlier suit on a different claim between the same parties. The practical matter is that nothing about a disqualification makes it necessary to anything that was approved, settled, or otherwise in the underlying action in the probate court. That was an action regarding disbursement of assets. They fought those issues out. There was never a trial in that case. There was never an actual judgment. There was an order approving a settlement and the disbursement of assets. There was nothing referenced there that would say, oh, and by the way, I couldn't enter this order if Mr. Goodsell had not been disqualified. It had nothing to do with the underlying action, and that action did not involve Mr. Goodsell. Part of the problem we run into on these types of cases
is, and it's maybe the lawyer's ego, when someone files an action for disqualification, the lawyer is all upset, as though somehow or another it's directed at them. It's the client that they direct a motion to disqualify. They're moving to disqualify a client's lawyer. The lawyer does not have that stake in there. The client has a decision to make as to whether to retain that lawyer or fight the decision. The client can fight the decision for a period of time, as they did here, but ultimately when Judge Ritchie entered his order, the client switched to another lawyer. My client was not in a position, ethically, to file any kind of a writ once the client's made that determination. It's against the client's decision. It's against the client's interest. And that's where the problem falls into here when we have lawyer-client involved in this sort of a situation. The client determined to go forward. The client determined to settle the case. The case was disposed of by settlement. Mr. Goodsell was no longer involved in this case as an attorney or any otherwise. And as a practical matter, he couldn't have done anything at that point in time. And we don't have a final judgment for this court to rely upon. We did cite Jarosz case, the Jarosz Palmer case from Massachusetts. It's pretty much on all fours here. The practical matter is that they've got different statutes on writs there. They have a single appellate judge that reviews them there as opposed to us maybe having two or three judges review a writ of mandamus. But the practical effect is once Mr. Goodsell's off the case, they've got a new lawyer, a writ of mandamus filed by Mr. Goodsell would not only be contrary to his client's stated intent at that point and be inappropriate, this court would put that right back down saying, what are you talking about? There's no harm here. The client's decided to go forward. There's no justiciable issue here. The federal court did deal with that and recited the case of David Chesnoff versus the United States of America, and they basically said, Mr. Chesnoff, you're not a proper party to any kind of an appeal here, any kind of an appeal of an interlocutory order, because you're not a harmed party. If your client wanted to sue, that would be one thing. And if you look at the cases that this court over the last 20 or 30 years has decided involving disqualification issues, virtually every one of them had the client as the petitioner. And to the extent the lawyer was joined as an interested party, they did, but the clients were the ones that filed those petitions at that point in time. Realistically, Mr. Goodsell was not in a position to elect independently to file an appeal, a writ or otherwise, and to do so would have been inappropriate. So what basically the plaintiffs or petitioners in this case are asking this court to say is, look, once it's been taken out of the lawyer's hands and he can't appeal, he can't get it reversed at that point, we want you to have that be binding on him, even though that wasn't his say-so as to whether or not that could be appealed. There isn't a finality in this case before this court, and there's simply nothing here for the court to impose issue preclusion or collateral estoppel upon Mr. Goodsell. In terms of the parole evidence, and Judge Bell was correct, the documents she was addressing at each stage were not the testamentary documents as such. They were, I hereby assign this count number 454 at Bank of America to the Adoria Frey Trust. There wasn't any allegation in any of the complaints, there wasn't any allegations at all by the parties in the action below in front of Judge Bell that somehow or another Dr. Frey was incompetent. In fact, he got up on the witness stand and testified at trial. They've never had a guardian appointed for him. They never asserted incompetency. They never asserted fraud or those sorts of things in the complaint. And that was not an issue of trial. They raised it for the first time here on appeal. But the practical matter is, absent some situation with a fraud or incompetency, the parole evidence rule is not going to allow somebody to take a just grossly unambiguous document like that and start testifying that it's something other than what it represents. Judge Bell looked at each document as it came in. She didn't just blanket grant our motion in limine, which we had. She allowed testimony by Dr. Frey up to a point, but she got him to concede, and he did concede at trial, that he had an opportunity to read the documents, and she did what good judges do, and that is to make as a matter of law a determination that whether a document is ambiguous or not ambiguous. Had she ruled they were ambiguous, we would have had testimony. The practical matter is we assert that she was absolutely correct in finding that the documents were unambiguous.
If we should happen to find that there's a violation of the parole evidence rule, is this reversible error or harmless error?
I think it's harmless error.
And why is that, Mr. Grant?
as a practical matter, I don't think that the documents themselves, in a jury looking at these documents, I just got to believe the court would have to state that the jury would find the intent of the document as to what it states. Even if the judge were to find that there was no testimony allowed, almost any person of any educated level looking at that one or two line, most of them one sentence, documents, I hereby transfer this to this account, would find that those who were unambiguous themselves and that they did state an intent to transfer, which is what the documents fundamentally did. As a last statement on whether something, the result is correct, even though the logic wasn't correct in arriving at the result, we did have a motion for summary judgment on damages asserted that basically stated that they did not have any expert testimony to support the damages that they were claiming. They did not have an expert who testified to that effect, and it's our position that to the extent you're claiming damages for a number of different transfers of assets, that that would require some form of expert testimony, and they didn't assert it at that time. But basically, it's our position that Judge Bell, we believe rightfully so, she didn't just find that she didn't think Judge Ritchie intended to do that. She also said, I don't feel in looking at this that there's a level of finality that the law demands in an issue preclusion situation. So therefore, I'm going to allow both sides to put their best foot forward with their experts, put on all the evidence at the trial, and let a jury determine the issue. And after 4 or 5 days of trial, the jury did determine that issue adversely to the petitioner in this case, and we believe properly so. I invite any inquiry by the court if you've got any questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cotton.
Thank you,
Judge. Rebella, Mr. Root?
Yes.
With regard to the parole evidence rule issue, there was testimony at trial that by Mr. Rushforth, the defendant's expert, that yes, these documents do what they say they do. But that misses the point. Because if Dr. Fry didn't want them to do what they say that they do, then we have documents that are drawn contrary to the settler's intent. And therefore, under this theory that Mr. Cotton and respondents are putting forth, there would be no transactional malpractice if the client couldn't say, no, this isn't what I wanted to do. It would eliminate that entire error. There is no case law that says interlocutory orders must be referenced in a final order. That is just not the law. NRS 155.190 lists what orders are appealable. Disqualification orders are appealable, whether it's directly, as we talked about before, or whether it's part considered interlocutory order under 155.190. That there is no law.
Cotton makes the point that it's appealable by the client, not the lawyer. Don't you agree with that?
Well, I think that the attorney could appeal that issue, whether it's through his client or on his own, because it affects the attorney. Because in this case, it absolutely affects him going forward, because it's the attorney who was found basically if you take it all the way, he violated the standard of care. He had an attorney-client relationship with a gentleman.
How would he have any standing in the action below to do that?
Well, he's been disqualified, so I think, he's the one who opposed this. Like, if you look at it, it's part of the record, the opposition, and then also the objection, the whole thing is based upon Dan Goodsell. Mr. Goodsell this, Goodsell that, it's all based on Goodsell. I didn't do this, I didn't have an attorney-client relationship. He actually didn't do it through the power of attorney. That was a misstatement. It's in the record. But Mr. Goodsell said, I don't think I was drafting these documents by a power of attorney, through Stephen Blocker's power of attorney.
So there was no power of attorney.
There was a power of attorney, but Mr. Goodsell says, I did it. Stephen Block was acting as a dutiful son.
As an agent on behalf of Fry.
He said as a dutiful son, but not under the, but I think it's
wouldn't that make him an agent anyway?
Well, I mean, I think that that's where the expert testimony is, that you can't do that let me take a step back. He's basically saying he had no attorney-client relationship. So he's not saying he had, his relationship was with the son. He's drafting documents for the son, but he knows the son is taking him to have someone else sign. That's the problem. That's where the malpractice is, and that's where finding that he had an attorney-client relationship by the probate court and by Judge Ritchie, that's what leads to the malpractice case. But I think this one other point is that can't be overlooked is that probate courts have to end, it ends in order. It's just different. And that's why it's a different situation. If this was just a case in district court, there's a stipulation for dismissal. But it's different because the probate court takes actual jurisdiction over the internal affairs of that trust. That's why the order was final and appealable in June of 2010.
Thank you. I'd like to thank counsel for their arguments here today and their briefs in this matter. The case will stand submitted.